Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the continuing fallout from the failure to indict a white NYPD policeman who choked a black man to death in an incident that was recorded on video by a bystander. Echo Yunker, a professor of law at the Cardozo School of Law at Yeshiva University, joins us to discuss how it is possible that the grand jurors who saw the video of the killing of Eric Garner could come to the conclusion that it was not homicide, which was the ruling of the New York City Medical Examiner. Then we will speak with Mel Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, who served in the CIA, State Department, Defense Department, and the U.S. Army. He's the author of National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, and we will discuss the deficit in leadership and strategic thinking in the Obama administration with the fourth Secretary of Defense in the past 6 years about to be announced at the Pentagon, and Mel Goodman's article at Counterpunch, The Dumbing Down of National Security Policy. Then finally, veteran foreign correspondent Rhys Ehrlich joins us in the studio to discuss his new book, Inside Syria, the backstory of their civil war and what the world can expect. We will examine the dire plight of the Syrian people caught in the crossfire between a brutal mafia regime and a patchwork of rebel factions, most of which adhere to increasingly extreme Islamist ideology, and the genesis of this almost four-year-long ongoing tragedy that has cost over 200,000 Syrian lives, displaced a fifth of Syria's population, and destroyed much of the country. And joining us now is Echo Yunker, a professor of law at the Cardozo School of Law at Yeshiva University. He also serves on the executive board of the Innocence Project and the American Constitutional Society's New York chapter. And his publications include A Paradox in Overcriminalization and Good Guys and Bad Guys, Punishing Character, Equality, and the Irrelevance of Moral Character to Criminal Punishment. Welcome to Background Briefing, Echo Yunker.
Thank you for having me.
And I take it that you're as mystified as I am that the grand jury in Staten Island failed to indict the police officer who used a banned chokehold on Eric Garner, causing his death, which the medical examiner ruled was a homicide, and yet the whole thing was videotaped by a bystander. It seems so clear. It's as though we're in an alternative universe.
And this has been absolutely stunning. Even those of us who try to remain measured in the face of depressing incident after depressing incident, we often remember our lawyerly training. We swallow hard and we say, well, it's about reasonable doubt. In this case, not even reasonable doubt, just probable cause. But we think to ourselves, we weren't there. We didn't see what happened. There are two sides of every story. And of course, then we cry the lament that we'll only ever hear one side of the story. In this case, there was a real sense in which we were there. Nobody pretends that videotape is perfect or shows all angles, but it's just impossible to deny that we were all witnesses to this in an important way. And for a grand jury to look at this videotape and see no probable cause for any crime has been not just dispiriting, but just startling, absolutely startling.
And apart from the fact that both of us are astounded by this, have you in any way tried to figure out what was in their minds and what kind of guidance the district attorney gave the grand jurors?
So we don't have any evidence yet as to what actually happened. I can say to the credit of the district attorney that he has moved to have the evidence released in New York. That's extraordinarily rare. It's quite rare in many places, but in New York it's extraordinarily rare, and it will be a judge that decides ultimately if there's a special enough interest to have that evidence released to the public. That said, I can imagine a jury not thinking he was guilty. I can perhaps imagine I can certainly imagine a grand jury not returning, obviously, first-degree murder, maybe even not returning second-degree murder if they don't believe his behavior is reckless. But to look at that behavior and not think that using a banned procedure, something that your own police force has told you is too dangerous to be casually deployed, and not see anything like negligence or reckless endangerment, I'm having a difficult time seeing how the grand jury thought there was no probable cause for any crime at all.
Well, I think the videotape, though, is not even more, but certainly as damning as it continues after Eric Garner has died from this chokehold and been wrestled to the ground. And another policeman, by the way, sort of stomps on his head, essentially on a lifeless body. And then he's sort of, you know, lifted on a gurney like a piece of meat. They don't seem to be in any way bothered. There's no sense of shock. I mean, you'd think that taking a man's life would have had some impact on those officers.
I don't know these officers, but here's what we do know. We do know that way too many officers have come to view the people that they're committed to protect as surly, indolent, or insolent. You know, the us against them mentality. The idea that officers are trained only to dominate situations. I, like everybody, am sympathetic to how dangerous being a police officer is. We're all pro-police, and people should stop trying to make this a pro versus anti-police kind of conversation. But we just can no longer stand for officers who think of the people they're policing as them, which makes it easy to not just dominate, but dominate in a way that seems to, as you point out, lack humanity. I mean, not only do you have to subdue somebody, but is there any need to literally crush his head into the pavement? This is the behavior of somebody who just wants to lord over somebody. Another officer is crushing his back. There's just a lack of even momentary decency.
So let's talk a bit about the title of your book and what it means. I mean, again, I'm still wrestling with the fact that how could a videotape that is so startlingly clear, not definitive, but startlingly clear, nevertheless, be in any way irrelevant in a criminal investigation?
So the piece I wrote, it now seems too long ago, but the piece I wrote did touch upon some of the things that still concern me about moments like this. Part of what I was writing about was that criminal law becomes dangerous if we think that crime and punishment is something like the state playing moral arbiter, like the state playing church. That is to say, it's too often easy to think of those who commit crimes, not just as people who've done bad things, and not even just as bad people, but as permanently bad people, some cast of permanent immoral creatures that are never to be cured. One of the places you see this most starkly is in California, where you had an era of real commitment to the three strikes and out regime, a regime which says no matter what your third penalty is, no matter what your third felony is, no matter how trivial, we will assume that any third felony means that you are no longer the kind of person that we have to be proportional towards. We don't have to measure what you did. We don't have to think about it. We no longer have to think about what's fair to you. We can simply throw you away. And that's the kind of thinking against which I warn in that article.
Well, when you were saying that the attitude or the apparent attitude of the police is that they're sort of an occupying army in an unfriendly territory rather than members of a community who they are serving. The Justice Department just came out today with a damning report on the Cleveland Police Department and many of the outrageous shootings, car chases, etc., that have gone on there recently. And, of course, only a week or so ago, a young, I think he was like a 12-year-old boy, was shot dead by a police officer in Cleveland because he had a toy air pistol, which was mistaken for a handgun. But in this Justice Department report, it points out that at the Cleveland Division of the Police District Station, in one of Cleveland's police district stations, there's a sign that hangs up reading Forward Operating Base, which implies, of course, that that station is in a war zone.
Yeah. I mean, what is true is that over the last couple generations, the police have become increasingly militarized. It's hard to know this if one isn't interested in the history of these things, but police forces were not always the way they look now. Certainly the modern police force is a new invention as we urbanized some 100 years ago. And we, for some reason, mysteriously decided that the model is going to be the military. So we have sergeants and we have forward bases. When one thinks about what that says about the relationship between police and citizen, it strikes me as incredibly dangerous. And on your point about young Mr. Tamir Rice, who is shot, you know, again, I'm sympathetic that when a police officer approaches somebody with a gun that's indistinguishable from a real gun, they are now in a position where they're going to shoot. That seems, we know that police officers are in incredibly dangerous positions. But a question we have to ask is why the police officer had to escalate the situation to where the only choice was going to be a fatal choice so quickly. So the video shows that he drives up. He's apparently yelling to the 12-year-old, hands, hands. He views the 12-year-old as a full-grown man, a full-grown threat. And there's literally 2 seconds between when the officer arrives at the scene and when he shoots this person, when he shoots this boy. It's hard to imagine that if we thought of this young man as somebody we valued, somebody who is one of ours, if we could see him, his humanity, if we could see a 12-year-old cute blonde kid who is misbehaving, that the first thing we would do is load the situation in such a way that the choices are going to be fatal.
And this police officer had not been on the job very long, and I believe he's certainly been suspended, has he not?
That's right. He was declared unfit for duty in 2012. And I think it was because his handling of his weapon was found unsatisfactory.
And I believe that also the officer in the Eric Garner situation in Staten Island, CBS News has reported that he has 2 lawsuits against him for brutality and for trying to set up people in a crime. So what does this say then about the kind of internal policing of the police?
No, I think you're exactly right. And these are police officers who we have reason to be deeply concerned about. These are police officers who in both cases have cost the city tremendously. In New York's case, has actually cost the city financially. And I think you're exactly right. It makes us really wonder about who's policing the police. And in this moment, I think it's well that we remember. It is also true that police officers who behave so quickly, so casually, who take life so easily, and who escalate situations so quickly, also dirty the name of police officers who are doing everything they can to help people. I witness police officers every day when I'm walking to work, helping people in distress, helping men who've struggling with alcohol and drugs. And instead of thinking of these people as immediate threats, they rather see citizens who need help. And those police officers, every good deed they do is washed away when another police officer thinks the most important thing is to dominate a situation at all costs.
Well, this gets to, I guess, training. But when you combine these events like Ferguson and Staten Island and Cleveland, what they all seem to have in common is that you don't really, and particularly in these grand juries where you never get to trial, so you don't really know how the defendant is being examined or judged. But in the case of Ferguson, it seems so obvious to me that Officer Wilson simply just lost it and in a blind rage because this Michael Brown kid had hassled him in his car and disrespected him. And it also, in the case that the Justice Department, in its report today on the Cleveland Police Department, in talking about this 25-minute car chase, these 2 teenagers, a young woman and her boyfriend, reached 100 mile an hour and ended up in the East Cleveland school parking lot. 13 officers surrounded the car and fired 137 rounds, hitting the 2 young joyriders, if you will, more than 20 times each. So, again, it feels like, you know, this is a bad movie, that this is, you know, we've seen this stuff in movies, and it's not supposed to happen. We're supposed to expect more from our police department. We know that they have a tense job, and quite often they are harassed and provoked. But isn't the training supposed to sort of train that kind of adrenaline, testosterone reaction out of them?
Well, I think there's no question. Everything you said strikes me as important in terms of not just lamenting what's happened, but in terms of making real changes going forward. And I'll just say three quick things. The one is exactly what you said. We have to change the way that we train the police. I've been very pleased to hear Mayor de Blasio speak today about not just making one-off changes, but making structural changes and starting to change the way that police are trained in our precincts and through the academy. And part of that goes all the way to the roots, that police needn't be trained, that the only response to every situation is to exert domination. I think, secondly, there's no relieving our courts of their responsibility. So our courts, starting with our Supreme Court, have made it extraordinarily difficult to hold police officers to account. At every instance, the court has decided not only to ignore important conversations about race and policing, but to insulate police officers from liability, even under extraordinary circumstances, and to separate a police motivation from what they view as a rights violation. And this means that there's an institutional lack of control about what we as a society want police to be doing and how we want to check them. But lastly, I think we're all quite responsible as citizens. So what's happened in the last few years is we have gone from respectfully understanding that the police have a difficult job and modestly and rightfully trying to listen to them and give them leeway as to what they need to do their job, to absolutely acquiescing to anything that a police department says is a necessary set of tools or a necessary set of actions they need to take. We cower when police say, you just don't understand what policing is like. And by the way, we do the same in prisons. We went from intelligently understanding that we should listen to those who know how to run prisons to absolutely acquiescing to when we see the most egregious abuses in prisons to some position like, well, the warden must know what he's doing. And we as citizens just can't do this anymore. We should be sympathetic and supportive of our police, but that does not mean abdicating our responsibility when we see what we know and should be committed to as bad policing, to do something about it, to vote a certain way, to populate our citizen review boards, and to insist on accountability.
But in terms of, you just mentioned the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court has defined the kind of ambiguity that is at the heart of these incidents, both in Staten Island and Ferguson. They use the word reasonable, and it seems to be the reasonable force or a reasonable response on the part of the police is not based upon what we think, particularly those of us who saw the videotape, but apparently what police think in a similar situation, or at least what they would think in a similar situation. So is that the nub of it, that the Supreme Court have given the police this sort of enormous latitude about what is reasonable?
Well, I think it's a multi-layered set of problems, partly touched upon by what you say. Not only has the court decided that a police officer's action has to be reasonable, but indeed they've decided in a way that we don't decide in most other fields, that reasonable means that no reasonable officer, in a 2012 ruling, there was language to the effect that so long as any reasonable officer would have done X, then immunity is still held. This is quite an extraordinary view of what reasonable might be like. But additionally, the court has explicitly ruled that an officer's motivation will never affect, well, I shouldn't say never, will not affect for Fourth Amendment purposes the reasonableness of their search. So the fact that an officer, for example, is racially motivated to stop and frisk you doesn't affect whether or not a police officer can introduce any evidence he finds. And if you can somehow magically prove, as against the Supreme Court's law in another field, that the officer was racially profiling you, something that's going to be very difficult to prove, then you can bring a suit, a civil rights suit of a certain type, but you're not going to be able to suppress any evidence. So what that signals to the police is they can take their shot. They can just try, and maybe they'll get evidence, and nothing will, no matter what their motivation is, nothing will stop that from coming in. And, you know, and after all, if they don't find evidence, most people are furious, they're upset, they tell themselves they should do something, but most of us don't have the time or energy to pursue a lawsuit every time we're harassed by a police officer. So we grumble, we take the scar tissue, we're furious, but then we move on with our lives, and the police officer continues to behave this way. These are the many ways in which the Supreme Court has stopped building a system that rewards and encourages good policing and has constantly protected bad policing.
Well, Eka Yanka, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Eka Yanka, who's a professor of law at the Cardozo School of Law at Yeshiva University. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the deficit of leadership and strategic thinking in the Obama administration.
Shot down in the street and died just because of the system. She cried out, 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 out. Johnny was a good man.
Oh no, oh well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more, yes, war no more. Well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Gonna lay down my hymn book down by the riverside, down by the riverside.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Melvin Goodman, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His 42-year government career included service at the CIA, State Department, Defense Department, and the U.S. Army. In 1991, he was one of three former CIA officials to testify before the Senate against the nomination of Robert Gates as Director of Central Intelligence on the grounds that he had slanted intelligence to suit policy. He's the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, and his latest book is National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. And he has an article at Counterpunch, The Dumbing Down of National Security Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Melvin Goodman.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you again.
And Mel, what's your sense of why, well, make your case that there's a deficit of leadership and strategic thinking in the Obama administration?
Well, the problem is very basic. If you look at Obama's national security appointments from day one, with the exception of John Kerry at State, I would say they've been mediocre at best. And that would include Hillary Clinton at State, Bob Gates, Panetta, Hagel, jury's out on Ashton Carter, of course. It would include all the CIA directors, Panetta and Brennan, actually. Is the wrong person, and the fact that he lied to the Senate Intelligence Chairwoman suggested he should have been removed, and that I won't even get into David Petraeus because King David wasn't there long enough to really judge. And at the National Security Council, he started with a retired Marine general who had to go because he couldn't articulate American policy, and he followed him up with a domestic affairs specialist, not a foreign policy specialist, and Tom DeNellen, and Susan Rice, I think, is in over her head. Add to that the intelligence czar, General James Clapper, and you have, I think, a terrible picture, and certainly a picture that does not provide for anyone who can speak to the strategic nature of American foreign policy. And that's why there's a lot of confusion at the Pentagon, particularly among general officers who are in key positions. But I think generally, if you read the op-eds, if you talk to opinion leaders, if you read international comment, and I'm not saying it's easy in this current framework, because I don't think there's any course to really chart when you look at the Middle East. I mean, this is a decline of an entire civilization. This is the barbarians at the gates. But you need someone to explain this. Susan Rice can't go into public arenas very often because she's still being attacked for what happened or didn't happen in Benghazi. Hagel was imprecise and inarticulate at his confirmation hearings, and he remained that way for the entire year, which is the reason, I think the major reason, why he was fired, because with his imprecision, it allowed military spokesmen, particularly a former student of mine at the National War College, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Martin Dempsey, to become the leading spokesman for military policy. And that's not the way the Pentagon should be run. That's a civilian leadership position. There should be civilian control of the military, particularly when American troops are fighting overseas. So it's a very mediocre picture. And frankly, I don't think the Ashton Carter appointment because most people were running away from being selected for that job, is going to really be a reversal. In fact, I think in terms of policy, Hagel out and Carter in really changes nothing.
So who could Obama have appointed, both at CIA and DOD? Because, you know, the assumption's always, and the same was true of Bill Clinton, that presidents with no military background who are babes in the woods should have choose strong leaders. Now, Clinton chose James Woolsey at the CIA, who was a catastrophe.
That was just awful. But, you know, Clinton and Obama share something, and that is neither one had any experience in military policy or foreign policy or national security policy, for that matter. Both indicated very early on that they were intimidated by the military and intimidated by the intelligence community. And both started out with cabinets in their first term that had to be replaced very quickly. Because if you look at Tony Lake at the National Security Council, that didn't work at all. Les Aspin had to be relieved of command at the Pentagon. Warren Christopher wasn't effective at state. And as you say, Jim Woolsey was a sop to the right wing of both the Democratic and Republican parties. So it's this appointment power. And I remember something President Eisenhower said on his way out: God help the United States if the people who follow me into the Oval Office don't know how to talk to the military. And Clinton didn't know how to talk to the military or listen to the military or deal with the military. And I would put Obama in the same category. But when you then appoint secretaries of defense, and frankly, Gates was guilty of this too, because he allowed General Petraeus, who my colleagues at the War College used to refer to King David because he was such an egomaniac, and then General Stanley McChrystal to speak for policy, this is not something that was helpful to the White House. Panetta wasn't active, so it allowed the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Dempsey, to be a spokesman. And under Hagel, it was even worse. And it started out in his confirmation hearings and went downhill. That was less than a year. That was late January, early February of 2014. And Carter, I think, is considered a policy wonk, but he's not a forceful person. And frankly, if you look at Carter's record, there were too many times, I think, when he thought the use of military power was the preferred option. He advised Clinton to use military force against North Korea, and Clinton, in that case, went for the agreed framework, which brought at least a freeze to their nuclear program in the 1990s. And Ashton Carter also advised Bush to use military power before the first test of a long-range ICBM. That was an ICBM that was up in the air for 40 seconds before it self-destructed. So I'm a little concerned about Carter. I know the military-industrial complex will like him because he is a weapons acquisition guy, and he was a forceful proponent of the F-35, which might even bankrupt the defense budget before it's done. Even Senator John McCain said he got sticker shock when he looked at what the F-35 was going to cost. So I'm not expecting any great things, but, you know, if you look at the last 2 years of the Obama administration, he's a lame duck president. He's got a course that can't be charted in the Middle East. That's a seat-of-the-pants operation. Who in the world would want that position? And most people ran from it. Senator Jack Reed made it clear he didn't want it, and I thought Reed would have been a good candidate in 2009. And Michelle Flournoy initially said she was interested, but I think she talked to the Clinton campaign or the Clinton non-campaign or the Clinton campaign in waiting, whatever you want to call it, and I think they told her, you know, if you want a position with us, this is no time to becoming Obama's Secretary of Defense. So she pulled her name out of the hat. Johnson, the Department of Homeland Security, you couldn't send him before a confirmation committee right now because they would take him over the coals for his position on immigration. And let's face it, these Republicans can't wait to beat up Obama on immigration issues, and they would certainly use the nomination of Johnson at the Pentagon to do that. So it's not any job, it's not a job that anyone wanted. Carter was disappointed when he didn't get it when Hagel was named and left kind of awkwardly and made it clear it wasn't a satisfactory relationship with Hagel, but now it's his show, and we'll be testing this immediately, because if General Dempsey continues to have the major role in speaking for American national security policy, then we'll know that Ashton Carter just isn't getting the job done.
But again, Mel, you know, you could add to the list of presidents who were babes in the woods when it came to the military. Ronald Reagan got teary-eyed every time the Marine band played, and he basically deferred to them entirely. Is there anybody out there that you could have found that would keep the Republicans at bay and also bring the gravitas that you're talking about that Obama's national security team needs?
Well, Carter did it, I thought, with Harold Brown, who had a background in weapons acquisition and in science. He was a very strong physicist in his own right. Ashton Carter is also a physicist. And Bill Clinton actually did it, even though he didn't have a strong background in military policy. After Les Aspin, which didn't work at all, he appointed Bill Perry. Bill Perry is probably the best Secretary of Defense we've had in the last 20, 30 years. And I thought when Obama took over in 2009 that he should send the message that things will be different at the Pentagon, but I think he was afraid to do that, which is why he kept Bob Gates, which I thought was a poor move on his part, because it suggested there were no Democrats out there to take the position. But someone such as Larry Korb, who was a deputy defense secretary in the Reagan administration, or Richard Danzig, who was Secretary of Navy in the Clinton administration, have both written wisely about changing certain policies, procurement policies, acquisition policies, tours of duty, the kinds of thing actually that Donald Rumsfeld tried to address in his controversial period as Secretary of Defense. So there are people out there, but I think he got off to the wrong start by keeping Gates. And then, of course, Gates wanted Panetta to replace him. He was on the short list that Gates gave to Panetta, as was Mayor Mike Bloomberg, of all people, on a short list of three or four people, because I think in the case of Panetta, Gates wanted to signal that things weren't going to be any different with Panetta in charge. And of course, Panetta was captured by the operational culture at CIA when he served as director of CIA, and he was captured by the flag officers and general officers when he was Secretary of Defense. You know, Panetta has a very strong background and a good public service career, but by the time Obama appointed him to these two key positions, I think he was a rather tired bureaucrat. He went home virtually every weekend because his wife wouldn't move back to California. He was ridiculed behind his back as Uncle Leon when he was at the CIA, and I think there was a lot of laughter over the fact that he brought his dog to work every day. So I don't think people at the Pentagon or at CIA thought this was a serious choice to begin with. Carter is someone they will have to reckon with, but we'll see how strong he really is, and we'll know that in terms of the role that Dempsey plays. If Dempsey, as I said before, continues to be that major spokesman, it shows that Ashton Carter is going to take a while to get hold of the reins at the Pentagon.
Well, it's pretty clear, Mel Goodman, that they're floating the idea that the American nuclear arsenal, particularly the land-based missile leg of the triad, is obsolete, and we've had discipline problems with the Air Force officers involved in that futile activity. Obviously, we can't make a deal with Putin anymore to reduce nuclear weapons, but at the same time, the idea that you have to modernize the entire nuclear arsenal and spend trillions of extra dollars just seems to be the most absurd waste of money, but that looks like it's happening. So I don't see a chance of the $600 billion a year Pentagon budget going down. That's the part of it that's amazing.
That's what's really worrisome, because somehow we haven't come to the realization that, okay, we're not going to agree with Putin on Ukraine and Crimea. That's just not going to happen. But there are too many important issues where the dialogue and institutionalizing the dialogue is extremely important. And strategic reductions in an arms control dialogue is one of those areas. The thing that worries me about Ashton Carter, in the 1980s when he was a Harvard professor, he wrote a paper for the Office of Technology Assessment making the case against Star Wars, against SDI. But then when he joined the Clinton administration, he began making the case for national missile defense. And under Obama, he was even making the case for a regional missile defense in Eastern Europe, which makes no sense whatsoever. And it added to all of the friction and tension that existed between Moscow and Washington over the past several years. So I think Carter is someone that the military-industrial complex is clearly going to support. I don't think it's going to be a controversial nomination process. I think the Republicans have already made it clear they can live with Ashton Carter. And I don't expect any real policy changes at all. He's just a horse holder for the next 2 years, and that's why not many people were rushing up to offer their credentials or submit a resume for this position. It's not a very easy job to take on at this point in Obama's second term.
So do you think there's any chance at all that Ashton Carter will get his hands around the Overseas Contingency Operations Fund, the OCO, which is a huge slush fund that the Pentagon uses to disguise how much money they actually have on hand?
Well, I don't expect any great changes there. And really, those are policy decisions that are going to be made in the White House. And here, I think Gates and Panetta did tell us in their memoirs that the petty tutelage that they had to put up with from the White House, from the National Security Council, was extremely frustrating over the years. Policy decisions were made in the White House. Cabinet officers did not have a major role. And, of course, Gates didn't speak up much in cabinet meetings, nor did Hagel. So there were frustrations in both directions. But I don't think Carter is going to get any closer to the White House leadership. There are rumors already that he doesn't have a good relationship with Dennis McDonough, who is the chief of staff for Obama and the most powerful man in the White House other than the president himself. You know, McDonough has been used for all sorts of missions, going to Germany to assuage Chancellor Merkel over the tapping of her cell phone, going out to California to try to deal with Senator Feinstein over the torture and abuse report that the White House has been blocking and the CIA has been blocking that should have been released by now. So if Carter can't deal with him, I don't think he's going to get his nose under the tent either. But he's been willing to take on this position because he's wanted to become the Secretary of Defense, even for this very difficult two-year period.
So if this guy is not likely to be up to the job and the job's not worth having, is there any chance that anything could be reformed at the White House itself, which seems to be the source of the problem?
I don't think so. I think, if anything, the wagons have been drawn even tighter than they were before, and the reports I hear that there's even a certain amount of suspicion and jealousy with regard to John Kerry and all the headlines he's garnered by taking on the three difficult tasks that include Syria, Iran, and Israeli-Palestinian relations. And there's a certain lack of trust in how far he'll go in these negotiations in order to get a deal. So there's a certain amount of paranoia within the White House, and the people who are making these decisions are not national security experts. They're not foreign policy experts. And if you look at the people Henry Kissinger had as a powerful national security advisor, he had genuine expertise, serious Soviet experts, serious Middle Eastern experts, Asian experts. You know, when Kerry travels and when Obama travels, I notice they rarely even take anyone from the NSC with them. That kind of expertise doesn't exist, and you have to wonder about the whole decision-making process in the White House as they try to work it out of their own pockets without taking into account serious cabinet officers who are principal members of the government and being the stewards of the Pentagon or a Foggy Bottom or the intelligence community. And that's why I think there is this picture of a administration that has no strategic thinker, no one who can address strategic thought. And you remember that not too long ago, Obama got into a lot of trouble, and I think he shouldn't even have used the word, but he said, we have no strategy on ISIS as yet. And then he made an announcement about air power and said, now we have a strategy. Well, that use of air power doesn't mean that you now have a strategic approach to the problem of ISIS. And again, that's not an easy policy conceptualize and then implement, but adding air power to a policy that wasn't working isn't really going to change anything on the ground to any significant degree, and it certainly isn't strategic. The game changer in the Middle East would be if we start to take Iran seriously as a country we could work with in certain areas. Here we are flying air missions in Iraq in the western part of the country while Iran is flying air missions for Iraq in the eastern part of the country, and we're led to believe that they're not communicating or coordinating in any way. Well, if that's true, I could see some terrible accident that's going to take place one of these days. I have trouble even believing that, but this is what Pentagon spokesmen are telling us. So And again, if you look at the U.S. discussions with Turkey over Syria, you know, where is the match there? Turkey wants to overthrow Assad. Obama says he doesn't want any part of that battle. He just wants to go after ISIS. Yet we expect the Turks to allow us to use our air base at Incirlik to avoid these long flights from the Persian Gulf into the Syrian border area with Turkey. So it's not a pretty picture, and I know a lot of military people from my days at the War College are mumbling about this because they really don't understand what their role is anymore in any of these issues. We just heard that elements of the 82nd Airborne are going back to Iraq. Afghan forces were supposed to stop their combat operations at the end of this year. Now it's been extended for a year or two. And again, there's just no consistency, no clarity in any of these policy decisions. And so I think, in a way, Hagel was unfairly tarred because he signed up for an administration that wanted to reduce defense spending and reduce the use of the military. And in the past year, since he's been Secretary of Defense, it's only been 10, 11 months, policies have changed. Now we want more defense spending, and now we're using the military more often than we plan to, and certainly that Obama wanted to, if you take his West Point speech seriously from June of this year, the graduation speech, and I took it seriously. So we're stuck in a policy that George Bush left us as part of his legacy, which was probably the worst decision any American president made on any national security matter, which was to invade Iraq in 2003. So it's not a pretty picture, and it's not an easy situation. And I think if Obama can get Carter confirmed easily without any great controversy, then he could consider himself successful in that phase of the game, because clearly Hagel had to go. He didn't demonstrate that he was really competent to run the Department of Defense.
Well, Melvin Goodman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Melvin Goodman, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His 42-year government career included service at the CIA, State Department, Defense Department, and the U.S. Army. And he is the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. And his latest book is National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. And he has an article at Counterpunch, The Dumbing Down of National Security Policy.
We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the backstory behind the Syrian civil war.
Until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain but a fleeting illusion to be pursued, but never attained. Now everywhere is war.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Rhys Ehrlich, a veteran foreign correspondent who reports regularly for CBC, ABC Australia, Radio Deutsche Welle, and NPR. His books include Target Iran, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy in the Middle East and the Middle East Crisis, Conversations with Terrorist Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire, and his latest book, just out, Inside Syria, the backstory of their civil war and what the world can expect. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rhys Ehrlich.
Thanks for having me.
And what can the world expect? Give me a thumbnail, a brief sketch of...
Well, I think in the short...
Can it get much worse, in other words?
In the short run, it's not looking good. With the new latest U.S. war going on, it's a serious problem. It's going to make the situation worse. It's taken the Islamic State, which was a local ultra-right-wing adherent of political Islam, and turned them into a world-famous organization. Their recruitment is up, and the fighting is not going so well. So in the short run, more disaster. But I do have confidence in the people of the region. For example, the people in Kobani, the city in Syria near the Turkish border, are fighting against the Islamic State, holding out with very sharp resistance. There's examples of people fighting the Islamic State on the ground. So in the medium and the long run, I'm optimistic.
But some of the fighters, the Kurdish fighters in Kobani, are saying that the Turks are coming, are helping the Islamic State outflank them from behind, literally, you know, on the Turkish border.
Well, it's a serious problem. There are allegations that the Islamic State is launching attacks from inside Syria. Whether that's done, from inside Turkey. Whether that's done with the approval of the Erdogan government, that's another question. It could be, because I've been at that border, and it's not real effectively policed, let's say, by either the Turks or by the Syrians. And so it's possible that some of those attacks are coming without the official permission of the Turkish government. But I'm open to hearing more information on that.
But in terms of the macro political situation, is there any chance that the agreement, of course, with Iran didn't happen? It's been delayed, but the expectation is that still an agreement will be made. And since it does seem that throughout this entire agony, the Russians and the Iranians have known exactly what they want. They've been resolute in their support for Assad. We've not been sure about who we're supporting and who the people are on our side and whether they're really on our side. So is there any chance that the U.S. either, one, will sell out the Free Syrian Army, or two, will be able to get Iran to ease Assad out?
Yeah, well, actually, the Iranians in the early stages of the uprising held talks with the Muslim Brotherhood and would have jettisoned Assad, who they don't particularly like because he's a secular dictator, if they had found a Muslim government that they would be friendly to Tehran. But that didn't work out, and of course, they've been backing Assad ever since. Yes, to answer your question, I think there could be, if the United States and Iran negotiate a deal on the nuclear power issue in Iran, it would be encouraging for Iran to try to reach a political settlement in Syria and in Iraq. They've already set up, in essence, a no-go zone inside Iraq with the Iraqi government permission to prevent the Islamic State from coming in. They're bombing Islamic State positions, as is the U.S. So objectively—
But we're not working together.
That's correct. That's important to understand. And just to make things even more complicated, remember the Free Syrian Army you just mentioned? The Pentagon cut off funding to them because they wouldn't toe the line on the latest switch in U.S. policy to focus on the IS.
Right.
So the U.S. is allied with the former enemies and fighting the former friends.
So, Reece Ehrlich, you know, there's an attempt to try and figure out what went wrong here. Obviously, this rebellion against Assad was the last in a series of the Arab Spring. In many ways, it was stimulated by what had happened in Libya, that had just happened in Libya with the fall of Gaddafi. The people took to the streets, and essentially, they were just mowed down relentlessly. And was there a missed opportunity there? That seems to be, everybody, Hillary Clinton, Erdogan, the president of Turkey, they all predicted that Assad was going to go. Obviously, they all got it wrong. But did we miss the opportunity to build up a secular or at least a moderate Islamist opposition?
I think Obama actually, contrary to the latest rewriting of history by people like Clinton or some of his other former advisors, he tried all the traditional U.S. methods of forming a supposed coalition of civilians who were the representative of the real government, not one but two. They formed not one but two different military coalitions. And the problem was nobody in Syria or no significant numbers of people in Syria want to adhere to the U.S. Positions politically and militarily in the country. That's at the core of the problem. And if the hawks had been in power and they'd been pumping more money into the so-called moderates, it just meant more of their weapons would have ended up in the hands of the extremists. There was no correct U.S. policy in a situation where the U.S. is a declining empire and the people of Syria saw what happened in Iraq, they saw what happened in Afghanistan, and they're not interested in that happening again.
You mean that they don't want drive-by liberation?
Exactly.
So, but what was the role of Israel? Because you talk about the right in this country. There's no question that there's a bond, if you will, between the Israeli right and the American right. The Israelis actually seem to be perfectly happy with the Assads. You know, this kind of a mafia
regime. They were
regime.
Initially, They were, it was the lesser of two evils. I visited Israel, and I have a whole chapter in my book about Israel and Assad and the uprising. And remember, of course, Israel continues to occupy the Golan, which is a Syrian territory that was taken in 1967, and every Syrian wants that back, regardless of what their other political views might be. Israel currently was supporting the Free Syrian Army, both in terms of intelligence and on the ground through the Golan, helping provide medical assistance to both civilians and Free Syrian Army fighters, and that's detailed in my book. And the most cynical interview I did with a former Israeli government official and current think tank guy was that they're perfectly happy with the current situation where Syrians are killing Syrians. It takes the pressure off of Israel, at least in the short run, they think. And it's a pretty cynical view.
But what was Israel's position over the red line that Obama drew about chemical weapons, and then he backed off from it and made a deal brokered by Iran and Russia?
Yeah, both Israel and the Israel lobby in the United States were urging very, very strongly the Obama administration to bomb Syria, and with the idea that using the excuse of the chemical weapons, the bombing would take place, and that would be the elements that toppled Assad, much as what happened in Libya. That was the plan. But it was overwhelming popular opinion around the world and in the United States blocked that. And for the first time in a long time, the Israel lobby was dealt a serious defeat. That doesn't mean they're overall defeated, but on that issue, they went down to a flaming defeat.
But prior to that, the Saudi defense minister and the French president Sarkozy had tried to buffalo Obama into bombing the Assad palaces. So it wasn't as if there hadn't been pressure on Obama all along. Was that just a kind of, you know, the idea of decapitation? As far as I know, it's never ever worked, has it?
No, but that doesn't prevent the United States from trying it over and over and over again. Most recently with Libya, right? You get rid of the evil dictator without putting American soldiers on the ground, supposedly, without spending that much money, just a few billion here, a few billion there. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to have U.S. intervention light, and it didn't work. It created chaos.
Well, again, another example of drive via liberation.
Mm-hmm.
So, but given the agony, which has cost over 200,000 lives, God knows how many in prisons. I had the most harrowing interview with a young Assyrian medical doctor who, because she's from an Alawite district, her ID saved her life. But her colleagues who went out in the streets early on, and then they were picking up all of the wounded kids and taking them to hospitals and treating them. And then the Muhabarat comes in and rounds up all the doctors, puts them into these hideous prisons. And on the way out, they inject them with either hepatitis or AIDS, you know, as a little gift. I mean, this is the horror of that regime. And, you've got millions of displaced people in Jordan and in Turkey. I just don't know how much worse it can get. And it seems to me that there's a sort of compassion fatigue in terms of the world community. You know, do you really think that we're basically turning a blind eye to this horror?
Well, I think there's limited options as to what the U.S. can do. Yes, Assad is a horrible dictator. I've detailed that in great numerous chapters in my book. And the atrocities you described are not even the tip of the iceberg. I mean, there's many, many more. But because you have a horrible dictator doesn't mean that the solution is for the U.S. to come in and do something. Mm-hmm. Whenever there's a big crisis that Washington is concerned with, usually having to do with oil or geopolitics or other issues of that kind, suddenly that issue becomes we have to do something about it. In the Congo, 5 million people were killed in the civil wars that have gone on there. And we hear practically nothing about it. Where's the outrage of the human rights violations there? Boko Haram in Nigeria, why aren't we sending troops there? Yeah. The simple matter is the U.S. can't and shouldn't send in troops whenever these human rights violations are taking place. Ultimately, the people of those regions will be able to resolve it, and the solution will be far more lasting than if it's imposed from the outside.
Well, given that, and you said that the attitude amongst the Syrians was they didn't want to have it. The U.S. helped them out in the way that they liberated Iraq. And if we're a spent power, then why is it that the neighborhood hasn't weighed in already? I mean, there doesn't seem to be any cohesion there in the neighborhood.
Well, the neighborhood
and
is
the neighborhood's
is,
falling
is,
apart.
Is, yeah, is just as divided as your neighborhood or where I live. You know, neighbors aren't just because your neighbors don't make you friends. there is lots of intervention by Turkey, by Saudi Arabia, by Iran.
Most of which hasn't been particularly helpful.
Exactly.
It's just built up the Islamic State, hasn't it?
Exactly.
And al-Nusra and whatever this new group, the Khorasan or whatever they call them.
Yeah, if that group even exists.
Yeah.
Yes. No, that's true. And so the fact that there's intervention by neighbors, it's each of them is pursuing their own interests as the United States does when it does this intervention. Mm-hmm. So my general view is to stop the U.S. intervention, pressure Saudi Arabia and Turkey to do the same, go to Iran and Russia and say, look, we've stopped it. You've got to, too. We'll sit down together and help facilitate a political solution. That's the only way it's going to end.
And just to pour a little cold water on that, things aren't exactly rosy between the U.S. and Putin, are they?
Not at all. There's obviously a whole set of other battles going on in Ukraine and elsewhere. But presumably, everybody could agree on Syria, particularly if the U.S. reaches an accord with Iran, which is the main backer. Russia is a backer, but if Iran shifted to agreeing that, for example, Assad could go, but some kind of a government friendly to it would remain in power, mm-hmm. that would do a lot to resolve the problems.
Well, just in closing, Rees Erlich, you know, again, it's the same thing happened with Iraq. I talked to people who actually speak Arabic, people like Bob Baer and Graham Fuller and others, and they said that this would be a quick victory, or we came to the conclusion it would be a quick victory followed by a slow defeat, while the entire U.S. press were cheering on this folly of Bush and Cheney. And it seems that in many ways getting into Syria was similar. I talked to people who knew Syria, who spoke Arabic, and they all said that Assad's not going to go. I mean, you know, I think the Defense Intelligence Agency actually came up with a report early on saying, no, you know, when Hillary Clinton and Erdogan were saying his days are numbered, you know, it seems like wiser people who knew the country and were saying otherwise. So is this another case that we simply don't have the intellectual ammunition to get involved in these countries? We know how to drop bombs, but we don't know who to drop them on.
That's certainly a problem. The problem is that it's not lack of intelligence. It's people pursuing a certain set of policies, regardless of what the reality on the ground is or what the policy recommendations are. In Washington, and again, I have a chapter in my book that deals with Washington politics in the Middle East, you have two choices. You have traditional interventionists like the John McCain, who's never seen a country he couldn't want to invade, and the humanitarian interventions that Obama and some of the people in his administration. But the idea that the U.S. should just not intervene at all, engage in humanitarian efforts, yes, political efforts, yes, pressure its own allies to stop intervening, yes, but no military intervention, that's off the table. When I suggested that to some State Department people that I met with, they thought I had landed from Mars. But ultimately, you know, we're going to see another defeat, another disaster for the people of the United States as well as for people of the region.
Well, Rees Erlich, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Rees Erlich, who's a veteran foreign correspondent who reports regularly for CBC, ABC Australia, Radio Deutsche Welle, and NPR. His books include Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy, and The Middle East Crisis, Conversations with Terrorist Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. And his latest book just out is Inside Syria, The Backstory of Their Civil War and What the World Can Expect. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing.
Bye for now.